Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome to Cure Talks. I am Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. And today on this 108th episode of Cure Talks, we are going to discuss about the legal aspects of assisted family building using artificial reproductive techniques. Assisted reproductive technologies have aided a modern-day couple's choice to start a family at their own preferred time in life. Techniques involving the use of donated egg, sperm, or embryo, or those like surrogacy, have helped many couples successfully build their families. However, if not dealt with cautiously, these technologies also hold the potential to disrupt families emotionally and physically, as they can give rise to their own share of legal issues. Issues like who would get the custody of the frozen embryos if a couple divorces, issues pertaining to the legal rights of the surrogate, the sperm donor, the embryo donor, or the egg donor, or issues arising out in cases of a disagreement between the intended parents and a third party involved. Due to such social and emotional complexities involved in the process of assisted family building, it becomes imperative for all the stakeholders to be educated about the associated legal aspects in order to be well equipped to take informed decisions. Today on this show, we have with us our eminent guests, Amy Demma, Wendy Wilson Miller, Nancy Block, and Alia Page, to discuss questions related to legal issues entailing assisted family building. Earlier, Amy was with us at Cure Talks last year to discuss about the options available for the use of remaining embryos left after a successful IVF cycle. Amy Demma is a New York licensed attorney and founder of Law Offices of Amy Demma, providing services to those engaged in assisted family building, specifically egg, embryo, and non-sperm donation, as well as compassionate surrogacy. Amy is actively engaged in many infertility patient advocacy groups and nonprofit and professional organizations. She served for many years as vice president on the board of Resolve New England, and in 2012 completed her tenure as president of the board of directors at Resolve New England. Amy is an admitted fellow to the American Academy of Assisted Reproductive Technology Attorneys and an active member of the Legal Professionals Group at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. She is the legal advisor to parents via egg donation and to the Society of Ethics in Egg Donation and Surrogacy. We also have Wendy Wilson Miller, who has been working in the field of assisted reproduction for over 16 years, an egg donor herself. She is the founder and co-founder of several profit and non-profit organizations, which includes Gifted Journeys, the Society for Ethics in Egg Donation and Surrogacy, Fit for Fertility, Nest, and Nest Egg Fertility. She also co-wrote a book titled The Insider's Guide to Egg Donation, a compassionate and comprehensive guide for all parents-to-be, which won a gold medal Ben Franklin Award in 2013 for its LGBT chapter. Wendy is also an executive board member of Parents Via Egg Donation and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine's LGBTQ Special Interest Group. Nancy Block on the panel is the Vice President of International and Major Client Relations at the Fertility Source Companies. She founded the Center for Egg Options in 2000, an agency specializing in gestational surrogacy and egg donation, now acquired by the Fertility Source Companies. At the Center for Egg Options, Nancy managed over 2,300 matches made with intended couples, intended parent couples, singles, and same-sex couples worldwide. Prior to opening the Center for Egg Options, Nancy spent 17 years as a nurse, staff educator, or resource coordinator at the OB unit, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, Prentice Women's Pavilion. Today, Nancy is a national spokesperson and guest speaker for many events in the infertility industry and sits on the board of Parents Via Egg Donation, as well as the Society for Ethics in Egg Donation and Surrogacy. My co-host for today's show is Alia Page, who is a speaker and author and who blogs at expirationdate.com. She is working to educate women regarding their limited reproductive lifespan and how to beat their expiration date. Alia and her friends, who have personal experience with assisted reproductive technology procedures and selecting of fertility centers started this blog to provide friendly and easy to understand information about preserving female fertility. They aim to educate people from the girlfriend's perspective. I welcome you all to this show today, and I extend a hearty welcome to all our listeners. And before we begin, I would like to remind our listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. You can email your questions to priya@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypads and we will bring you on air to ask them. Or you can also post your questions on CureTalks website as you listen. Now, let me begin this discussion by asking a very highly debated question to Amy that even the courts have struggled to answer, and that is about defining an embryo. Now, what is the definition of an embryo in legal terms, Amy? And is an embryo considered a child?
Good afternoon, good evening. Hello to all of my colleagues who are participating in this wonderful event this evening, and welcome to all of our listeners. Thank you so much, Sweta, for this wonderful opportunity to address current issues. Before I start, I want to be sure that your listeners understand that the matters that we are discussing today, while there are some universal standards, we are talking about matters that are state-specific in the United States. So I will be providing general information based on my many years of working in this field, but the takeaway from this must be that any person who is struggling with the legal aspects of assisted family building should be speaking with an attorney licensed in their state. So let me just throw out two resources for folks to get more specific state-centric information available to them. So the American Bar Association has a committee of attorneys that do the work that we do, and one can access their members to find an attorney licensed in the state in which a patient lives or a surrogate or a donor lives. And also the American Academy of Assisted Reproductive Technology Attorneys also has a directory. So listeners should take note tonight, learn much, I hope, from Wendy, Alia, Nancy, and myself, but also understand that with respect to specific matters, one needs to understand the law in their state. So, with respect to embryos, in defining of an embryo, we actually go to Tennessee. That's where we're going to start our discussion. In 1992, there was the first ever state Supreme Court analysis of what an embryo is. The ruling in that case, the case was Davis versus Davis, the ruling in that case is still relied upon today. And essentially, and this was a marriage dissolution case, where there were, in fact, frozen embryos, remaining embryos, and the parties were fighting over the ultimate disposition of these embryos. And the Tennessee Supreme Court held in 1992 that embryos are property entitled only to be handled in a careful manner, and that embryos occupy an interim position entitling them to special respect because of their potential for human life. And that's where I underline that statement, potential for human life. They are not human life. They are not persons, but they are more than just property because of this potential for human life. Now, just recently in California, we had a very important case, the Finley case, which I'll talk about later. And the Finley case basically said the same thing some 14 years later, actually some 24 years later, that Davis said, and the Finley court said, embryos are not property, nor are they fully formed human beings. So whatever the space is between property and human beings is a very vague area where embryos reside. But if your listeners and my colleagues can take away this notion of embryos having the potential for human life, I think that's the best understanding of what an embryo is.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer, Amy. Let us move to some legal considerations around the modern fertility patient. Have the legal considerations evolved as the profile of the modern fertility patient has evolved? And have the courts in the U.S. evolved in the rulings on assisted family building matters? How have the other countries responded, basically, to the modern fertility patient?
Yeah, so I'll answer this from the legal perspective, but I'd love for my colleagues, Wendy and Nancy, to also share. Their perspective on the modern fertility patient is different from mine in that we respond to different needs of the patient. So I'll answer your last question first. Globally, frankly, I don't see much that's encouraging. Globally, there are still tremendous barriers. There's a significant lack of legal infrastructure around assisted family building in many, many countries around the world. I'm going to suggest that perhaps the United States is the most progressive in the way we provide services to those hoping for a baby and needing assistance. So there's certainly no universal statement that I can make, and I certainly hope that what we're doing here in the U.S. can be influential globally. The modern family building effort from a legal perspective is really very interesting in 2016. So we not only have same-sex couples who are attempting family building, which was something that was relatively rare when I entered the field, we also have single persons who are pursuing parenting on their own, either with the use of their own gametes and a donor, or the use of two donors or embryos. So that's the profile of the modern single or the modern fertility patient, from my perspective. The law, however, has moved rather slowly, and the law has moved rather consistently with respect to things like embryo disposition. We'll get into that later in the discussion. We'll talk about some high-profile cases involving celebrities. The two cases that I've just referenced, both the Davis and the Finley case, did not involve celebrities. They ended up being high-profile, relatively speaking, in the media. But the courts have been slow, the courts have been conservative, and the courts have been consistent. With some exceptions, and we'll talk about those exceptions.
All right. Okay. Let me just hand it over to Alia now to take this discussion forward. Alia, are you there?
I sure am. Thanks so much, Sweet. I appreciate it. So, Amy, just have a question. So just to make sure that our listeners have a really clear baseline understanding of the concepts that we're discussing today. Let's just start out with having you define what is informed consent, and also what are the typical questions that a patient may have to answer in order to give informed consent.
Okay. As I was preparing for our lovely talk this afternoon, I went in two directions in terms of providing comprehensive responses to these questions. I want to be sure that we understand that informed consent is actually a different issue than embryo disposition directives defined at clinic. So I will answer your question first about informed consent, and then we can talk about these embryo disposition directives that tend to be at the core of the cases that I'm going to be referring to today. For the most part, we don't see assisted family building matters ending up in court, I'm happy to say. Typically, when they do, it is the parties who came together to present the evidence who have had some sort of change in status. So two parties come into a clinic with an intention to build a family. As a result of technology, embryos are created, and they will fill out certain documents at that clinic. Sometimes that relationship dissolves, we end up in court, and that's where we're getting our our case law that we rely on when counseling clients. Informed consent is something different. So informed consent is a document that almost any patient in the United States, hopefully every patient in the United States, who is submitting to a physician for a medical procedure will sign prior to engaging in the procedure. Essentially, an informed consent is a document that states that the patient has full knowledge of risk and benefit. And these consents can be anything from one page to I've seen consents that are 20 plus pages at fertility clinics. There is not a universal informed consent that is used at infertility clinics, but I will share with you that the Society for the Assisted Reproductive Technology, the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology, SART, SART, has in fact issued a model informed consent form to its clinic members. That model informed consent form is widely used. And I took a quick look last night at their model egg donation informed consent form, and it's 22 pages. So these are informed consents are bulky documents that address the procedure that the patient is presenting for, the risks related to the procedure that the patient is presenting for, statistics related to those risks. They can address things like short-term risk, long-term risk, pain, discomfort. In the SART egg donation model egg donor consent form, there were even matters of psychological and mental health issues addressed, lifestyle issues addressed, financial issues addressed. An informed consent should be that comprehensive. It should give the patient everything he or she needs to know to voluntarily and in an informed and knowing way proceed forward. Again, that form is different than the embryo disposition directive form.
Okay. Thank you so much for clearing that up. I appreciate that, Amy. So as far as the embryo directive consents and those sort of shared consents, what should a patient do if their spouse or partner is not in agreement with some aspect of the consents that are being signed?
Yeah. Okay. So I made reference before to a California case, the Finley case, that just was resolved within the last several months. Finley was a divorce case. Mr. and Mrs. Created embryos prior to the wife, her name is Mimi Lee, prior to Ms. Lee being diagnosed with cancer. Eventually, the marriage dissolved. Ms. Lee only had those embryos as an opportunity to build a family with her own genetic material. Despite the dissolution of the marriage, she went to her husband in hopes that he would agree to allow her to use the embryos. He refused to allow her to use the embryos, and litigation ensued. One of the matters that the Finley court looked at, and this is the most recent ruling we have here in the United States, so this is current law. One of the matters that the Finley court looked at was whether or not this embryo disposition directive that they signed at the clinic was in fact legally enforceable. And the Finley case in fact held that these contracts are binding between the parties. So an embryo disposition directive form, assuming that it's not a faulty or flawed form, and we will talk about a faulty or flawed embryo disposition directive when we discuss the Sophia Vergara case, but assuming that the document is as it needs to be and meets all the standards for a legally enforceable document, the court held that this was a binding agreement between these two soon-to-be-divorced folks. And so I would say to a party who comes to me and says, I don't agree, my emphatic directive would be do not proceed, do not sign. These embryo disposition directives will be enforced in court unless, of course, there's some flaw in the form. And so you are entering into a signed agreement, you are signing rather a legally enforceable agreement, and you'll be bound by it. So if you are not in agreement with your partner about embryo disposition, please seek the support of a mental health counselor who will help you work through your differences of view.
Okay, that's just really sound advice. You know, it's interesting. Back in 2011, when I froze my eggs, the forms that I was provided and signed were actually for IVF procedures. They didn't have forms at that point in time for vitrification or egg freezing. It just wasn't being done at that time. So I also know of several other legal cases where same-sex couples, for instance, have decided to have one partner provide the egg and the other carry the pregnancy. However, their paperwork at the clinic that they went to was not specifically for their situation. So in those kinds of cases, what should a patient do if the practice they're going to does not have legal documentation to address their particular fertility plan?
Yeah, so I hear those as two separate questions, and let's address the first. A party goes in to any medical facility for a particular procedure and is asked to sign a consent form that is not reflective of that particular procedure. Again, I would emphatically counsel a client not to sign that document. And in fact, I would argue, I think there's a strong legal argument to be made that informed consent was in fact not given. Informed consent is indicated by signature on that form. If that form is not addressing the particular procedure that you are going to receive from the medical provider, you're signing a form for a different procedure. You've not given informed consent. So I'm certainly hoping that clinics that are now providing eSight cryopreservation have updated their consent. The second is a little more tricky. First of all, I will share that I read an article quite recently, and it was just, I read a lovely, lovely statistic. Apparently, there's an entity in the United States called the Human Rights Campaign Foundation. And in a recent finding, the Human Rights Campaign Foundation found 500 U.S. fertility centers to be leaders in LGBT healthcare equality. That's incredibly encouraging. So if I had a client that came into me, a same-sex couple, and said, my clinic doesn't have paperwork that reflects modern family building, I'm likely going to advise them to consider working with another clinic. If we have 500 clinics in the United States that are meeting this standard of LGBT healthcare leadership, other clinics need to follow that leadership. Having said that, that would be my advice, that that clinic may not be the best place for the same-sex couple if they are not accommodating the unique needs of that same-sex couple. Having said that, it is not as concerning to me if two women sign an otherwise comprehensive consent form and one of them signs on a line that says father or husband or male. I'm not as concerned about that. Don't think that's going to disrupt the enforceability of those documents. I think it's a matter of, frankly, it's a personal or perhaps an ego issue. If you can get past that and sign a form that doesn't indicate your particular gender, for example, because you really love this doctor and you really love this clinic and you want to work with them, then I would support that. But I'd also have the bigger discussion of possibly working within a clinic where the culture is much more progressive and accommodating to the modern family.
Sure. That makes sense. So, you know, you kind of referenced this a bit earlier. There have been several celebrities that have been in the news regarding their various fertility battles. We've had Sherry Shepherd and her, I believe, now ex-husband separated during their donor egg and surrogate pregnancy. We also had Sofia Vergara and her ex-boyfriend separated while having frozen embryos stored. Will we continue to see more of these legal battles in the news? And is this a reflection of our society in general?
You know, the matter of media coverage, and I look forward to hearing both Wendy and Nancy's input on this, I think is a reflection of a culture that we're seeing now here in the States. There is a particular push towards religious interests. There are conservative political agenda being pursued. Our media tends to find those issues quite interesting. There's a lot of controversy around assisted family building. So do I think we're going to hear more of the cases in the media? I think these cases sell magazines and, you know, capture the interest of the general public. So unfortunately, I think the media exposure may in fact be on the uprise. Do I think that necessarily is a reflection in an uptick in litigation around assisted family building? I do not. I think that my law colleagues and myself are more committed than ever to establishing best practices and more committed than ever to educating and partnering with our medical and mental health colleagues to be sure that we are proceeding in a manner that is safe and protective of all parties, including a child, by the way. So I don't think that we are in a at a place in time where we're going to see an increase in litigation, but I do think we may, in fact, see much more mainstream media coverage of these things simply because they captivate the general population.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely salacious, that's for sure. So, Wendy, what is your feedback and thoughts in reference to how this is changing in our society in general?
I'm going to have to agree with Amy on a lot of it. I think a lot of it is the media exposure. But where I can jump in on it and talk a little bit about the organization that I co-founded with some other colleagues, the Society for Ethics in Egg Donation and Surrogacy, is kind of another response to a lot of the media coverage you're getting. But it's not just the media coverage. It's what we're hearing in general. You know, on whether that be in social media or any other areas that we're getting feedback from our community. So the response really is, how can we really streamline this industry? How can we reply in a tone of solidarity and also on behalf of our surrogates, of our egg donors, of our intended parents who are about to start this process? So I think it's really causing most of us to come together and create something that makes this a safer environment for our intended parents. But I agree with Amy, I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's those type of stories sell. And because this is something that more and more people are accessing, we are going to hear more in the future. Yeah.
Nancy, did you want to share any of your thoughts in reference to this?
Well, I have to agree with Amy and Wendy. I think social media has brought the topics to the forefront. And it's very interesting because when I first started, which was about 16 years ago, people didn't have the internet information that they have. They didn't have the social media information. We didn't even start with a website. So people didn't really see what they needed to see from the internet or a web-based platform. They had to come in and meet with us and be face-to-face and talk with us about what their needs were and how we could help them. So it has evolved, it has changed, and I think, you know, in some cases for the better because it's bringing the topic to the forefront, but I think in other cases the media hype with a lot of the negative situations and scenarios that have occurred aren't helping the industry either.
Okay. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You know, this concept of intended parents, it's specifically defined as people who want to have children but are not able to use conventional methods to achieve success. So, Wendy, with that said, what does the intended parent in advanced fertility look like in 2016?
Well, I think it's really changed certainly since I started in the industry in 2000. So there's certainly been quite a few changes in the last 16 and a half years. Initially, when I started, pretty much all of the paperwork, anything that we talked about, the websites that you would see were always more focused on traditional couples, although I'm not even sure that term applies to the current family landscape. But like married male-female relationships, mostly in the United States. Whereas now I would say that nearly 50% of my business, and I would say that quite a big percentage of most of my colleagues as well, also works with people internationally, and you know, about another 30% same-sex couples. So, and that's both international and domestic. So Another thing that I've noticed and another change is that I'm also seeing a lot more single fathers than ever before. Early on when I started in this industry, there were some agencies that wouldn't even work with single fathers because they felt that egg donors would have adverse reactions or surrogates, whereas now that stigma is definitely changing and has changed quite a bit. And I would also say how we label family in general through the agencies is the main change that I've seen from when I first started. So most art professionals now use the term, you hear this a lot in our industry, love makes a family, which is not only true, but it's a far more inclusive to the many different types of families that we see.
That's awesome. Nancy, what has your experience like been like as far as how the profile of the intended parent has changed over the years?
I would definitely say we have far more educated intended parents, more international, more same-sex couples. I think some of the cases are more predictable, but I think they're also at the same time more complicated because we can't say that automatically when a client comes in they're going to need to work with a donor and a surrogate. We'll have to educate them. We'll have to find out what their history is. I think patients, though, by and large, are somewhat more educated than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all obviously know that this is 2016, and social media is how we promote pretty much anything where we want to reach a wide range of people. But, you know, Nancy, how has social media impacted the process of sourcing information and people for egg donation and for gestational surrogacy? And I guess the other kind of bigger, broader question that I'm sure some of our listeners want to know is, how do intended parents know who to trust?
I'm sorry, I just had to take a break. Is this question for Nancy?
Yes, it is.
Sorry. I'm going to start with the last question first. How do we know who to trust? That's a broad. I can answer this in probably multiple hours, but I think that it's very important to talk to as many people as you're capable of talking to that are experts in the industry. Social media is certainly not always a reliable source of education. It's certainly not always a reliable platform to get information from that may or may not be trustworthy. I think talking to your doctor's office, talking to those people that you trust. I certainly think referrals are helpful. References are very helpful. I think talking to your colleagues. Wendy and I and Amy have known each other for a long time. We are all over the United States, but we do constantly talk to each other to find out what's new, who is new, what's going on in their section of the world, what's going on in our section of the world. Even though I'm a nurse, Amy's an attorney, Wendy's also in the industry, you know, we're all in different levels, but we all still work together. And I think it's valuable to be able to communicate with your colleagues to make everybody's experience as best as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Wendy, what has your experience been like with the incorporation of social media?
I think social media has been both very good, almost invaluable in some cases, as a source of information and education. It allows people to hear other people's experiences, who they've worked with, what the ups and downs of this journey can be, hear other people's feedback on agencies and clinics, and just kind of in general become a little bit more educated. But because it is social media, obviously that's another place. There's more public shaming. There's some aggressive opinions. Some are subject to obvious bias. And, of course, there could be misinformation because you're really not always hearing back from professionals. You're just hearing other people in some of the support groups. So I think the benefits definitely outweigh the negatives when it comes to social media as a source for information, especially when it comes to the support groups. But I think if I could give advice to intended parents first going through this process and really wanting to research would be to seek out some of the nonprofit groups, such as Resolve or PVED, Parents Via Egg Donation, contacting SEEDS, and we can put people in contact with various other people in the industry, and as Nancy said as well, talking to the physicians and the nurses because they've often had a lot of experience with agencies, if it comes to agencies, and of course agencies and other people on the support groups would have feedback regarding the physicians.
Yeah. So, you know, Nancy, I guess just as far as some of the advice, what are some of the most important facts to consider when a couple or intended parents are selecting a reproductive endocrinology or an infertility practice? And, you know, even though it can feel really intimidating, mm-hmm. what questions should intended parents need to make sure they ask their reproductive endocrinologist?
Okay, I'll go in order. I think it's very helpful to get current statistics from your fertility center. Many of the statistics that are posted on ASRM and SART are 3 years old. So they're a little bit older, so it's always good when you do make your first phone call to ask the person that you speak with what their current stats are for use with an egg donor or surrogate or both, depending on what they perhaps need or based on their age. I think it's important to have an office that's accessible for you. Hours are really important. Everybody works crazy hours. Many offices open up early before most people have to go to work. If you are an insurance-mandated state, that is, if your insurance will help pay for some of your IVF treatment, I think it's good to know if they accept your insurance, and appointment wait times. It's also important that they seem to be organized and responsive. I think it's really important when you go to a doctor not to be tongue-tied. It's very important to ask questions that you need to ask when you're there, because you have such a little time with your physicians these days that you need to get out what your points are. So I think it's important to know how long your first appointment will be. What will that first appointment entail? Do they get to meet the doctor at that first appointment? How many times will they have to come in? Will you verify if insurance covers any of the testing? Some patients will have to go to their OB for some of the testing, which many patients, women, obviously don't know until they get there. So that would be another appointment that they would have to go for before they get answers. And follow-up calls. Who makes follow-up calls? Is it the nurse? Is it the doctor? Or is it via email? I think in this day and age when patients, like I said, have few moments with their doctors, it's important to get as many answers as possible that first time, or even before the first time they go in.
Yeah. That's really great questions, and I wish I would have talked to you before I started my podcast.
Yeah,
great
I know.
Intel. So, you know, sort of really looking at the industry itself, Wendy, what do you think are the advantages and even disadvantages to embryo donation, and do you think that this is a real viable option for most intended parents?
I'll start with the advantages for embryo donation. At this point, I would say the number one advantage would be the cost of the process. They're going to save significantly on that, because they're not going to be paying for a donor egg or donor sperm. And, you know, I would say it probably saves them somewhere in the thousands. And in most cases, I would say, at least at this point with embryo donation, there have been previous successful pregnancies achieved with the embryos. So in most cases, I would say they're probably more or less proven embryos. So there is some comfort knowing that there is a good chance to have a viable pregnancy. The disadvantages, more than anything, is probably information and choice. So information and choice would be the biggest disadvantages. With an egg donor or a sperm donor, you have a lot of opportunity to choose both the health history, what someone may look like if there's somebody that you feel you connect to, and that's not always going to be the case with embryo donation. Less likely of a chance for there to be future contact with embryo donation. There could be centers that hold embryos that oversee this, but a lot of times people do embryo donation through their actual clinic, so there would be less information that way. So those, I would say, are the main advantages and disadvantages. And do I? The other question was, do I think that this is a viable option for parents in the future?
Mm-hmm.
I think what we want to be careful is not to get into embryo creation, which is probably we could do a whole other show on. And there's a bit of controversy about that in our industry as a whole. But I think it is a viable option because there are several intended parents that I work with who over the years have come back to me and asked if I knew of anyone who would want to use any of their leftover embryos, and they didn't feel like they wanted to destroy them, especially when they had children through those same genetic connections. So they felt that it was very important to give someone else the opportunity to do that. But you have to go back to, in that situation, what legal contract did the donor sign? Because it's about 50-50. In half the cases, we'll go back and we'll read the legal contract, and the donor will clearly state that she doesn't want any of her eggs to go to anyone other than the intended parent she agreed to. And then the other half typically say it's fine. In most cases, they want to at least be informed if the embryos have been donated. So I think it's a viable option. Do I think it's going to be the number one option? No, I don't think so.
Okay. You know, I personally followed a very circuitous path to fertility success, which included 2 rounds of IUI and 2 rounds of IVF. And ultimately, we did not have to use a donor. However, I have to believe that using donor sperm or a donor egg or even a donor embryo or using a gestational carrier can be a very difficult thing emotionally to personally manage. Nancy, how can you share with our listeners how you counsel people and work through these difficult issues with them?
I think not having gone through fertility issues myself, I suffered multiple miscarriages, but I didn't go through fertility or the same fertility issues that many of our clients go through. I do think that there are emotional ups and downs when we work with clients who are considering egg donation, sperm donor, and a surrogate, or all of the above. There have been clients who've come to us who I didn't feel were really ready to proceed. They came in teary. They talked to me on the phone teary. They really weren't ready to proceed, and I do tell clients, patients, that when they consider working with a donor, most people aren't 100% sold on the idea. Most people even going through the process aren't 100% until they see their baby. So it's okay if you're not 100% into the thoughts needing to work with an egg donor or a surrogate. We do understand it's maybe a very good alternative, but not everybody's ready. So some people need to go through either that grieving process or they need to go through additional steps before they can move on to the next step, which would be using a donor and or a surrogate. We also give referrals for intended parents to talk to other intended parents who are, like I say, on the fence about their decision to work with someone. I have never had intended parents who've ever said that they've regretted their decision. Most of our intended parents have said that they felt that they wish they'd come to these conclusions sooner and started this process sooner. But I tell them, really, until you go through certain phases of fertility treatment, you may not be able to move on to the next phase, and that's okay.
Yeah, that was definitely my own personal experience as well. I really appreciate that. Wendy, how do you have any thoughts about like how you would counsel people working through these same issues?
Yeah, there's a couple responses I have to that. One of the things that all of us realize when we work in agencies is that the people that are coming to us are oftentimes experiencing grief and letting go of their own biological connection while at the same time keeping that energy and hope alive with us to move forward with their family. And it's our job, to the best of our ability, to be able to know when they're ready to move forward and when they need a little additional support, when to suggest that they speak with a mental health professional specifically who works in this industry, so that they know and feel informed about what the process of assisted reproduction, egg donation, surrogacy is like, and to be prepared for it. I'm with Nancy. I haven't personally gone through assisted reproduction, so I can only go by my experience, my colleagues in the industry, our mental health professionals, and pretty much, you know, others who really discuss with us what people need and how we can support them as an agency and how not to push them through when they aren't ready.
I'm sorry, it's Nancy. I think there is one more key piece. As a patient, you want to feel that you have some control. As a client, you want to feel that you have some control. So I think it's really helpful to give our clients the ability to make their choices, and I think we all do that, and assist them and support them as they go through. And I think mental health professionals do a great job in working with patients.
So I had something to add as a follow-up to both Nancy and Wendy, in that really the best strategy in moving through this really emotionally, psychologically, often spiritually complex journey is to build a proper team. There are so many different disciplines that one can bring to one's family building, assisted family building. Obviously, we're going to need medical professionals. In many cases, but not all, we will need legal professionals. I think an invaluable part of the team is our mental health community. I see the mental health, our mental health colleagues being as integral in the process as the medical team. And then accessing the support through the various consumer advocacy groups like CVED, like Resolve, like Path to Parenthood. The resources are out there. And I think one of the reasons why Nancy, Wendy, and I were so willing to participate tonight is because we've also taken the role of an advocate. And part of the role in advocacy is raising awareness. So if folks are out there who are feeling disconnected, lost, confused, worried, afraid, please know that there are folks who have walked the path that you have. Some of us have. I had my own infertility journey. But putting together a team that will provide the resources that you need really is a best strategy.
Definitely agree with that. You know, Amy, one other question is, you know, for those intended parents that are fortunate enough to be successful, a pretty typical ethical issue that those individuals have to consider is, you know, what to do with the eggs or sperm or specifically embryos that are left after they're successful. What are the options for patients in this situation and in any specific considerations as well?
Well, your option as a patient who has created the embryos are as follows. One could choose or have cryopreserved gametes. One could choose to have them perpetually cryopreserved. As long as you're willing to pay storage fees and likely have to move your embryos from storage facility to storage facility, because they'll only typically only hold the embryos for a certain amount of time. By the way, the amount of time that a clinic will store your embryos should also be referenced in that embryo disposition directive form we were talking about. So the patient should be put on notice as to how long the clinic will keep the embryos frozen before they'll have to make a next decision about disposition. So obviously, using them for their own family building is an option. Keeping them perpetually frozen is an option. Those are two options that are least appealing, it seems, to clients. The folks who have to resolve residual or remaining cryopreserved materials tend to either consider thaw and discard, donation to research, either fertility-related research or other medical or scientific research, or donation to a third party for family building, that wonderful, wonderful family building option called embryo donation we were just talking about. I'm a huge proponent of embryo donation. I think families who would have been priced out of assisted family building have come to be because of the generosity of folks who have chosen to pass along their remaining embryos. But the options are keep them frozen, use them, discard and thaw, donation for research, and donation to a third party. There is another option, a rarely tapped into option, when women can have an embryo transferred at a time when she is unlikely to become pregnant. I don't know too many clinics that are doing that, and I know even fewer patients for whom that's an appealing option.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, embryo donation is just, it's such a gift that people are sometimes brave enough to give. And so I completely agree with that. And just also for our listeners, cryopreservation is essentially freezing the embryos for storage also. Okay, at this point in time, I'm going to transfer this back to Shweta for listeners' calls.
All right. Thank you, Alia. We have some listeners' questions. I'll just read them out. What kind of agreement needs to be done between intended parents and embryo donors regarding anonymity? Does the donor has the right to know who is going to use their embryos and also maintain contact with them as long as they desire to? I guess, Amy, can you answer that question, please?
Sure. And let's just be clear. When we use the reference donor in an embryo donation, we also have to consider whether or not there was an egg donor used to create the embryos. So the embryo donors may not, in fact, be those who provided the gametes to create the embryos. Wendy beautifully addressed that early on, so I don't want to repeat because Wendy really nailed it, but if, in fact, there is an egg donor involved in the creation of the embryos to be donated, we may need to go back to inform that egg donor that the embryos are being donated. If, in fact, the parties who are donating the embryos are the progenitors, are the providers of the gametes, they provided the egg and they provided the sperm to create the embryo, there are no rights, there are no legal rights, so to speak, that entitle the donor to information about the recipient. What a party who is considering embryo donation can do is shop around from facility to facility, from clinic to clinic, from program to program, as these programs do really vary, and find a program that fits and feels good to them. So I have some medical colleagues who do embryo donation through their clinic, and they run a strictly anonymous program. The parties know nothing about each other, and there's no exchange of contact information and no anticipation of future contact. That's one way of doing embryo donation. It is not the only way of doing embryo donation. At my office, I will often draft embryo donation agreements between known parties that have some intention of some sort of future contact or at least an exchange of contact information. So there are lots of options for folks who are considering donating and lots of options for folks who are receiving donated embryos.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for your answer. The next question that the listeners ask is, what new laws are being framed to avoid the increasingly complex legal issues arising due to more and more people deciding to create embryos and then separating?
Yeah, so I don't know of too much legislation, state law, or certainly any federal legislation that is thinking about embryos in that context. There may be pending law out there. I'm just not aware. The law that we have, the legislation that we have out there related to embryos tends to move in a very conservative direction of wanting to define embryos as persons, and that's a very complex and a different discussion than the discussion that we're having. With respect to case law, I did talk to meaning law that's coming from a court. So there was a lawsuit and a judge made a decision, and the decision has been published, and we now understand that it's a reliable law. The most recent law is the Finley versus Lee case. That's F-I-N-D-L-E-Y versus Lee. That came out of San Francisco just several months ago. And it addressed many of the issues. It addressed what is an embryo. It addressed whether or not the embryo-directed dispositions are legally enforceable. And ultimately, it held in the favor of the husband who did not allow the soon-to-be ex-wife to use the embryos. So if parties are looking to current law, I certainly suggest that you access that case. And my expectation, although we still have the Sophia Vergara case out there, that case has not yet been resolved, and we are looking forward to seeing what the courts are going to do. Because what's interesting about the Sophia Vergara case is their embryo disposition directive form that she and the gentleman with whom she created the embryo signed at the time of the embryo creation was in fact faulty. It was a flawed form. It did not address the dissolution of their relationship and what should happen with the embryos in that case. So we are all waiting to see what the court is going to do with that. But if you're looking for current law, I'd look to Finley v. Lee out of San Francisco this year as a reliable indicator of how these matters are handled in court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. The next question says, what are the agreements that are required by the law to be signed between a surrogate and the intended parents in the U.S.?
Okay. So, again, back to where we started with this conversation. This is very state-specific.
State.
There are many
Correct.
States in the United States that have no surrogacy law whatsoever. There are states that, in fact, outlaw surrogacy. So there's no universal legal requirement. However, the standard or the best practice, and this is absolutely supported by our medical colleagues, who will not proceed forward for the most part, or should not be, without a gestational carrier agreement. And the gestational carrier agreement should be written under the state law that applies by an attorney who's licensed in that state. But there is no legal requirement on a federal level. There are some states that do require gestational carrier agreements. Not all states have same laws.
Okay. All right. Okay. And the last question is, I think you have already answered it. In case a couple decides to get divorced after creating embryos, who gets control of those frozen embryos?
Yeah.
I guess that's the most debated question. Yeah.
We know in Finley that as long as the consent form is not flawed, as we expect the court will at least consider in the Sophia Vergara case, those are legally enforceable contracts. And so whatever it is that the parties agreed at the time they created the embryos is very likely going to be what will be the ultimate outcome of those remaining embryos. Likely, not 100%. We have seen some courts deviate, but generally speaking, the party who does not want the embryos to be used, the party who is not interested in parenting with his soon-to-be ex, generally wins in these cases.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for answering all these questions, Amy, Nancy, and Wendy. And with that, I guess we need to now wind up our discussion as we have already reached the end of our scheduled time. So thank you so much for answering our questions and finding time out and sharing your expertise with us. Alia, thank you so much for co-hosting the show with me and for your insightful questions today. It was a pleasure having you all with us today. And audience, I thank you for your support. And we look forward to having you all join us for our next Cure Talk on men's sexual health and male fertility in October. I will be announcing the date and time on social media very soon. For more information on this talk and the other upcoming shows on Cure Talks, please visit our website www.curetalks.com, or you can also email priya@trialx.com. I would love to hear your feedbacks about Cure Talks on fertility and reproduction, and I would welcome your suggestions on fertility topics that you feel should be covered here on this portal. Please email your suggestions on shweta@trilex.com or priya@trilex.com. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all the participants. And before you call it a day today, please don't forget to check out the details of the America Walks study. America Walks study is a mobile app-based research study to determine walking behaviors in individuals in the United States. Find more details about the study at trilex.com/AmericaWalksstudy. So until the next show, thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Anybody still on? Are we?